So you grew up on Cape Cod?
Well, no, I grew up in around New York City, mm-hmm. but my parents had the summer house.
And they still have it?
Well, actually, they live there year-round now.
Mm-hmm. You get back a lot?
I used to. The older I got, the more difficult it became to afford it. The more difficult it became to impose on my parents, and the more difficult it got to simply afford the summer rents around there. So I go back a little now and then, but not all that
often. Usually crash with them, though.
Well, or somewhere. I have enough friends around there that I find one place or another to stay.
Didn't lose any during your tenure as a cop in Wellfleet, did you?
Not really.
I think there was one incident, as I recall. It's been a couple of years since I read the book, but yeah. I think there was one incident where you made an arrest that was a very unpopular one.
Right. I unwittingly picked the son of the chairman of the Board of Selectmen as the very first person to arrest. That probably made me fairly unpopular around the town, but I only stayed a year after that, and then I was gone.
So. You're a most unlikely policeman.
I was a pretty unlikely policeman, possibly even more unlikely then than now. I think I cut a fairly distinctive figure in a uniform.
They didn't give you much training either, did they?
Actually, none at all. There was a peculiar requirement or loophole, actually, in the law, which allowed me, I think, to work something like I took the job for a year, and it allowed me to work almost an entire year without having to attend the academy because the sessions of the academy were staggered. So I showed up at about 5 minutes of eight one Saturday night for my first shift, and they put me out in a car, and that was it.
That's really scary, giving an untrained, unqualified person a gun and telling him to go on out and patrol the streets. That's scary. I mean, you see these people walking around with guns, and I have no confidence in policemen in general carrying guns, and to know that there are some officers in these small towns hiring summer cops without any training at all and giving them weapons, that's really scary.
Well, fortunately, I think there are fewer of them than one might think for me. It was not... I was fortunate enough in that I never came across any reason to use my gun I never got scared. I mean, nobody ever startled me. I was, that might have been, I don't know what would have happened then if I was really faced with something.
I just got back but over the summer I was in Cape Cod in Chatham.
Oh, yeah.
And I was reading the local newspaper there, and they have an article on crime.
Uh-huh.
And actually, I guess, police doings, police investigations. And I think the worst crime was someone rifled the Coke machine at the dry cleaners.
That's heinous.
Yeah, and a couple of vandals knocked over some mailboxes.
Yeah.
And so I was going down the list, and there were a whole bunch of drunk driving arrests and things like that. Yeah. I was going down this list, and it's incredible. It's almost idyllic.
Yeah.
When you come back to New York and you read these horrible crimes, I mean, hideous crimes, and then...
Yes.
You recall in the small, placid area like Cape Cod, where hardly anything goes on of any note in terms of violence.
Right.
It's comforting.
It is comforting. Unfortunately, the problem that the small-town policeman, I think, often runs into is that they work 5 or 10 years with not a single thing happening, and then they happen to be unlucky enough to pull over somebody who actually really is dangerous, and they get shot, or they walk into they answer a call from some husband and wife who are fighting, and the man turns out to be drunk and to have his gun in his hand and shoots them or something like that. I think that's really the danger that they run, but it's infrequent. As a matter of fact, when I was riding Midnight, I lived in a small town in New York State, and while I was there, a state trooper was shot as he got out of his car, walking up to the door to answer a call of a fight between a husband and wife, but otherwise not much really happens.
It's still safer being a police officer than being, say, a taxi driver.
It might be.
You have 20 taxi drivers murdered during the course of a robbery to any one police officer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe the figure's not that high. I might be exaggerating. But I think a year before last, I think there were 19 taxi cab drivers who were shot and killed.
I remember they had
killed during robberies in the city of New York, and one police officer.
Right. I remember the marches they had.
Statistically, it seemed that it's more dangerous to drive a cab than to walk a beat. Right. Where in the New York area did you grow up?
In Yorktown Heights, which is in northern Westchester, and in Tarrytown.
Where'd you go to high school?
I went to a school called Hackley, which is in Tarrytown.
Mm-hmm.
Small private school. I guess it's mainly a day school now. It was mainly a boarding school when I was there. I was a day student.
Mm-hmm. And then where'd you go to college?
I went to Bennington.
Mm.
I don't exactly know why, but I did.
You probably wanted to have the honor of paying the highest tuition in the country. I think Bennington and Wellesley, aren't they the highest tuition colleges?
I think Bennington has a perverse intention to maintain its lead over everybody. I think I'm convinced they wait until they have little spies who ferret out the tuition costs of every other college, and then they tack $150 on to the highest total they can find.
And did you like Bennington?
They need some distinction. I had a pleasant time while I was there, but I would have preferred some things that they don't really provide.
And, such as?
Well, I don't know how much you know about the school, but it's a school, at least when I was there, which is the early 70s, which had no requirements for within departments. I mean, a student could go through Bennington, and I think that there was... You could take a rather eccentric variety of courses and still manage to graduate with what was considered a liberal arts education. They also put a great deal of weight on things that are very new, very brand new, things that have happened in the last 30 minutes, and they tend not quite to value things that happened earlier. It seemed to me, I was a music major, it seemed to me what they considered important was music of the 20th century and music of the later 20th century and perhaps music of the last year or two before. And not a great deal of weight was given to any particular... Their thought was that music exists if you want to investigate it. The other music before the 20th century, then you go to a library and you take, or a record store, and you take the records out and you watch the course, which is a fine, which will work for perhaps one out of every 25 students. The other 24, I think, would prefer. I suppose what I'm saying is that what I would have preferred to have had out of a liberal arts education was a context in which to continue an education, which I don't.
You
think
felt that Bennington wasn't provides. Giving you grounding in the basics.
I guess that's one way to say it.
But you did
now. I'm much more fond of it now. I mean, I think I think it had a difficult period then because it was then sort of a mainstream college, which it has no business being. It's always been sort of an alternative to other places. And I think now that these generations have become so conservative and minded towards business that perhaps Bennington again has a place as an alternative to that kind of obsession.
What year did you graduate?
In 1974.
Armed in 1974 with a music degree, what happened next?
I was armed with a .38 Colt revolver.
Oh, you went right into the wealth
immediately.
Force.
Immediately. In fact, I missed my graduation because I was working midnight to 8 that night. So there was no, I didn't miss a beat. But and I stayed there for a year.
Mm. What happened then?
Well, then I went. Then I traveled for a while. Went to Europe for a time and tried to make a living as a musician. And came back and tried to make a living as a musician. Also started to write, and started to write Midnights.
What sort of musician were you? Or are you?
I wish I still were. I'm a failed musician, is what the kind of musician I now am. I was mainly a rock and roll musician. I mean, that would have been what I wanted to do. But at Bennington, I took whatever courses seemed to be.
Did you play an instrument?
I was a guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Composed too?
And right, music.
Did you have a group, or did you play as a soloist, or what?
No, I played. I had lots of bands. I mean, I was in lots of bands of this or that thing that would play around.
So you travel around Europe as a musician?
Then I traveled, on my own, trying to, playing on the streets, doing just sort of traveling.
At what point did you join the New Yorker?
In 1980, I guess. I was living on Cape Cod, and I had finished writing Midnights, and I was writing short stories that I would send to the New Yorker, and they would send back. And I guess they're really all that the only possibilities that seemed open to me on the Cape were to be either a fisherman or a carpenter, or to give music lessons or something like that. And I just thought I wanted to try something else. I didn't really know enough to be a carpenter, and I didn't really know anybody on whose fishing boat I could work. So I decided that I would try to be in New York City, and so I came here.
And how did you finance your stay in New York during these early days?
Who do I have to say? Mainly on unemployment money, I guess. Mm-hmm. I found an inexpensive place to live, and on the Lower East Side, and the money I got, about $110 a week, I guess, from unemployment, and that covered my rent and everything else. I felt like I was living in a pretty good style.
You had guts coming to the big city with a limited payroll living here. It's very expensive. But yeah. Did the New Yorker begin to accept some of your material?
Well,
I should say, at what point did the New Yorker begin to accept it?
They never did accept the stories. And I think by sheer persistence, I eventually broke down their resistance to the short pieces that I was writing for the Talk of the Town, and some of those began to run. And over a period of years, I just began to do more of them, and then...
At what point did they put you on staff?
After a while.
Meanwhile, you were contributing pieces to Talk of the Town.
Right.
And they liked those well enough after a period that they did finally put you on the staff.
I guess so. Nobody ever really tells you how it works.
Are you a staff writer now?
Right, I have on the staff now.
But you say you don't know because nobody...
Nobody ever says, we hired you because.
I see.
At one point, the next step was to go and ask if I could have a job, and then said, well, you could have a job, and that's it. There's no real formality to it. It's a pretty informal arrangement, and there's no explanation. There's no... nobody explains how the phones work, or... where to get your pencils or things like that. You just sort of somehow kind of, the door opens and you stand there and try to figure out what to do.
What's it like being a staff writer for the New Yorker?
Well,
whatever that means. What is a staff writer?
I guess what it's like, what it made possible and what I think it does, so far as I know, it's the only place that really makes possible the kind of work that is done there, which is to say, at least from the point of nonfiction, of providing you with the time and the expenses to look into something to whatever extent one wants to look into it, which goes from the kind of very short, regularly appearing kinds of pieces that Calvin Trillin reports to the much longer ones of, like, say, Mark Singer's recent piece on the Penn Square Bank, or which, they're pieces that take... some people short periods of time, pieces obviously take them much longer. But so far as I know, there isn't really... I wanted to work at the New Yorker because I couldn't imagine anywhere else I could work. During that year, I was fairly desperately trying to get any job I could get writing in New York City. I applied at the Daily News when they had their afternoon section. I forget what that was called. Daily News Today, maybe, was it?
Something like that.
I tried to get a job at Woman's Day. I tried to, which was actually fairly embarrassing that I couldn't, because my father had been the art director there for 30 years. So I was trying everywhere to get a job, but I was really obsessed by the idea of trying to work at the New Yorker, because that seemed to me the only place that was going to let me write the way I hoped that I would be able to write.
Well, do they give you an office and you report there, say, at 9 o'clock in the morning, or can you work out of your house? Or
well, they give one an office, and but there's no requirement that that you use it. It's there if you want it. I happen to work there on the premises, but lots of people don't. But probably more people don't than do.
Do they give you? Does William Shawn give you an assignment?
The writers, so far as I know, come up with their own ideas. I'm sure he suggested ideas to various writers when he has some idea and some writer in mind who might be the person to do it. But so far as I know, everybody suggests his own
idea. How many staff writers does it have?
There's no way of telling. I think once somebody told me that there were 75 people, writers that were under, roughly, that were under contract to the magazine.
William Murray is a staff writer, he says, and he lives in Los Angeles.
Right, there are lots
of... So I've always wondered how this description of staff writer works at the New Yorker, because I have a feeling it's not really a staff writer in the sense that you actually go on, like we have staff writers at CBS. I mean,
right.
they come in and they work 9 to 5 and or later hours or odd hours and weekends, but they're actually on staff, as opposed to people who are per diem or freelancers.
Right. Well, so far as I understand, what the term means at the New Yorker is simply that it's a person who has some kind of contractual agreement to provide work for the magazine. And so that's why there are so many people spread out all over the world.
For which you are paid a regular salary? Or are you paid by the piece?
I think there's all sorts of arrangements. Some people have drawing accounts. Some people perhaps have salaries. Some people are paid by the pieces. There are so many different generations of writers there, and I think different arrangements were tried at all points to try and come up with the most satisfactory one to assure the magazine of receiving work and also assure that it would be the best work that those writers were able to do.
Well, whose idea was it to do a profile of Garland Bunting?
That was my idea.
How did you get this idea?
I read about him in the newspaper, and I was attracted to him immediately because he sounded like a con man, and I sort of admired his faith in himself and simply walking into situations armed with nothing but his ability to talk his way in or out of something. And I guess I've always liked to listen to people talk, so I just
he's
thought
the man
I would
to
call
do him. It, isn't he?
He's a talker.
How many trips did you make to North Carolina?
I think I made about 6 over the course of about a year and a half.
You were working on other things at the same time.
Well, I was sort of working on other things at the same time, and plus, I would go usually for about 10 days at a time, and I think at a certain point I'd wear out my welcome, because I would really sort of. I just shattered him all the time.
So he was suspicious of you at first.
He thought that when I called him up from New York City, that he'd somehow done something, arrested someone or interfered with someone's still or some that who was involved with the mafia. And so he thought that the only explanation or a good explanation for why he'd be getting a call from nobody he'd ever heard of before in New York City was who wanted to meet him was that they were trying to arrange a contract on him.
You are as unlikely a looking hitman as you are a well-fleet cop.
I'm as unlikely a looking hitman as Garland is a woman when he dresses up as one. Somebody told him the other day when he was explaining that, they stopped him mid-sentence and said, "You must be the ugliest woman anyone's ever seen."
Did you take a tape recorder? I noticed you have long stretches of dialogue.
No, I wrote it all down. When I very first tried to interview somebody years ago, I took a tape recorder and I got home and there was nothing on the tape recorder. And it hadn't worked at all, so I decided I would never do that again.
We forget about moonshiners in this part of the 20th century with liquor so accessible, but I guess there are pockets of America that are still dry, and it's really unbelievable. This it looks like Garland has rounded up hundreds of moonshiners, and I mean, living in New York, you just don't think about things like that.
Right. Well, when I first went down there, I couldn't quite understand why there were any down there. And the explanation is, as you say, the fact that there are still a lot of dry counties. North Carolina's own liquor laws are extremely eccentric. There can be dry counties, or dry towns within wet counties. There can be practically any arrangement of circumstances, and there are practically nowhere in the state is a person able to buy liquor by the drink, except in a few of the larger tourist areas have some arrangements like that. But so there's lots of work for anybody who wants to have a sideline business or even a mainline business selling whiskey.
I used to live in West Virginia, and we used to drink moonshine, but the way you describe it in here, without the controls over its preparation, using paint thinner in it and a lot of unsanitary elements to it, I would never do it again, I don't think.
That was another thing that amazed me as much as anything else, was to go down, because a person who knows or has heard of moonshine generally hears of it in a kind of respectful, hears it spoken of in a kind of respectful way, as if there were craftsmen out there in the woods coming up with a certain powerful concoction that was superior to anything that he could buy. And I was amazed to hear what a filthy product it is, and what a dangerous product it was. So that occupied me for a while, trying to find out track down people who knew about what was in it and how it was made.
After six trips to North Carolina and going around with Garland Bunting, did you reach any conclusion about Prohibition and these odd, quirky, dry counties? Wouldn't it be better just to scrap all of these archaic laws? Wouldn't it make things easier? I know it would put Garland out of work, but wouldn't it make it easier for everybody in the long run?
I really don't know. I will tell you that one thing that I found that was very comforting about the arrangement down there was that it was nice to be to be able to drive on the roads at 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning, as I was doing a lot, and know that the person coming towards me was not guaranteed to be drunk, which is what I assumed to be the case in Massachusetts. When I was a policeman, I couldn't believe the numbers of people that were drunk on the road at that hour.
Yeah, but what guarantee in North Carolina did you have?
Well, it's just so hard for them to get anything to drink. You're not driving down a strip that has, in a quarter mile, seven bars that are advertising happy hour or something like that.
No, but a little planning, you stock up.
Oh, well, that's possible too. But I just mean a person who's drinking a person who was drinking in North Carolina might be more likely to be drinking at home or drinking somewhere else. It's just if you just don't see it around as much. It doesn't seem to be as much a part of, at least the life a person sees in the towns as it does. I mean, liquor is really in Wellfleet, where I was a policeman. Liquor was really part of the fabric of wintertime life there. I mean, you would see if one stood in front of the liquor store for a period of the day, one would see practically many people of the town coming in to make their purchase for, you know, this or that evening. But whether or not it's better, which is something one doesn't see, and, you know, there simply aren't really liquor stores are pretty far between in North Carolina. You know, there could be 30 miles between one and another one. I don't know if it's better or not. I don't know the answer to that question, but that's what comes to my mind.
Well, have you talked to Garland since the publication of Moonshine? What's his feeling about being the subject of a book?
He loves it, and it was actually, that was perhaps the biggest reward to me was that he liked it, and he's been showing it around a lot down there, so as a matter, I sent him the galleys before it came out so that he could read it and make sure there was nothing he wanted me to change in it. And I began to find that he'd been passing them from one person to another down there. So that was rewarding. And he's a theatrical character, so I think
he's not a afraid that his cover might have been blown?
Well, he's been blowing it himself. If that's his worry, I don't think so really, because he doesn't really work undercover much around where he lives. It's usually far away, and he's a pretty well-known figure. Everyone in Scotland Neck or Halifax County knows who he is. So there's no cover to be blown within, say, a radius of 50 miles.
Well, it's certainly a nice book, easily read and short, which is very helpful to somebody who does a broadcast every day on books and authors. Are you going to try your hand at fiction at any point?
Well, I hope so. I hope to. I work on things every now and then, but mainly I'm trying to make a living these days. So I think that the kind of ease of mind that a person needs to work on fiction doesn't really go along with the idea of trying to keep things going ahead, one at a time. I'm also just at this point in my life just. I think I'm more interested in the things that are going on in the world around me than the things that are going on within me, so that keeps my interest.
Have you picked up your guitar lately?
I never do, not in years. So.
Well, Alec Wilkinson, I thank you very much for coming in and sharing your background and how Moonshine came to be written. I appreciate it. It's a delightful book.
Well, thank you
very
much.
You.
Thank you for having me.